Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about part 2, chapter 15 of Anna Karenina. What was your favourite line of this chapter? I asked that because it was a particularly pretty chapter. Lots of nice descriptions of the farm, of the land, not the farm, the forest where they were hunting. What did you think of the dog having an internal monologue? How were the dog's thoughts translated in your version? I don't know why I really fixated on the fact that the dog had thoughts, but it was just such a strange thing to find in like a literary classic, like a Scooby-Doo dog's brain thinking in English. It's so weird. Like, I don't know. I don't think he meant it to be like comical or cartoonish. Or even like literal, like the dog didn't literally think those English thoughts. or Russian, as probably was in the original. But I would never, ever put a dog's thoughts in my book if I was trying to have that book be taken seriously. but I love that he did and kind of got away with it. And yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I really fixated on that. And the third question, Venus and the bear constellation mentioned. Do you think there is a symbolic reason? Format Kaka says, in the pause of complete stillness there came the rustle of last year's leaves, stirred by the thawing of the earth and the growth of the grass. Imagine one can hear and see the grass growing, Levin said to himself, noticing a wet slate-covered aspen leaf moving beside a blade of young grass. Pure gold. How could someone describe such a simple situation so beautifully? Reading a book slowly really makes you appreciate such instances. Yeah, it makes you stop and smell the roses, makes you stop and notice the grass growing. The ending of this chapter is kind of confusing to me. All the time Oblonsky has been here, Levin has wanted to question about Kitty. On hearing that she might not live, he recovers pretty quickly from the shock, celebrating the kill. Weird. Swim said the mama fishy said, Tolstoy's descriptions of the landscape are amazing. Having known many avid hunters, I lived in Idaho for 25 years where hunting is not just a sport but a vocation. Levin and Stever's actions did not surprise me at all. Techrific said, regarding his weird, quick recovery from hearing the news that Kitty might not live. Yeah, I agree, but when you're doing something like hunting, even if you are chit-chatting away, your mind is focused on the task at hand. I suspect in the aftermath of this, when they are safely home, Levin will worry a bit more about the news of Kitty's illness. Tolstoy just shows us his insights into these types of situations where you're in a sort of meditative state of total focus on the task that everything else just drifts by your consciousness without really disturbing it. It's hard to explain if you haven't experienced this sensation for yourself. I think there might also be that little factor of, like, when you hear shocking news, I do this all the time. When I hear something awful, I just sort of don't have a response. I'm like, oh, wow, that's terrible. Anyway, what were we doing? And then I kind of dismiss it almost and go back to whatever mundane sort of thing is more present, more immediate. And later think like, wow, like that person told me this really bad news or this thing, you know, heavy thing. And I barely acknowledged it. I've done that a few times before, weirdly, you know? Maybe that's just something I've done. But it's a weird reaction to, like, shocking news. It's almost like a bit like denial, maybe, even, where it doesn't sink in. Or shock, maybe, something like that. Swim said the mama fishy, said, regarding number 3, about the symbology of the stars, I'll bite. Venus is, of course, the goddess of love. Many myths about use Ursa Major revolve around hunting. Levin finds out that Kitty did not marry Vronsky and is, in fact, seriously ill. Levin, the hunter, still has a chance in love. Here is an interesting interpretation of Stever and Levin simultaneously shooting the bird. Both men hitting the bird suggest how victorious they feel in terms of love. Interesting. Really enjoyed this hunting chapter, says Terrific. The descriptions of nature were all exquisite, and the description of the constellations so familiar. Is there an equivalent constellation to the Big Bear in the Southern Hemisphere, Ander? The Big Bear is so much part of winter here I live. Part of winter where I live. I don't know why the addition of snow and darkness makes you gaze up at the stars, for comfort. Maybe it's some residue or echo of harder times when darkness was a real worry to deal with. Is there a equivalent? Well, I don't really know if there's... I can't think of like a constellation that's like... that I associate with winter necessarily, but... we've got the Southern Cross, of course, down in Australia, which is the kind of diamond shape that you would see on the Australian flag. If you look up the Australian flag. I'm looking it up now. I don't know why. That's the Southern Cross, which points south somehow. When you see it in the sky, it forms like an arrow that points south or something like that. And, of course, it's only visible in the Southern Hemisphere. It's on the... it's also on the New Zealand flag, the Southern Cross. But I don't know. I don't know how that compares to the bear. I don't really know the significance of the Big Bear, because, well, I've probably never really noticed it, never seen it. I've only been in the Northern Hemisphere on a few occasions and didn't do that much stargazing. Sure, there's symbology in the constellations, and Tolstoy must have been very familiar with Greek mythology. Ursa, Major, the Big Bear, is associated with Callisto, a mistress to Zeus, for whom his jealous wife Hera exacted revenge by turning her into a bear. Later on, in his grief, Zeus placed her in the skies. Sound familiar? Stepan is a cad much like Zeus. Venus is, of course, the Roman equivalent of Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, and what is nature, if not beautiful, and Levin is preoccupied with both subjects. So, I think those adds to the story of underlining the mental space for both Stever and Levin, but in a nice, deep background sort of way. Loved the humour of the dog's thoughts, really worked for me. Overall, another good chapter. I Am Norwegian says, I didn't think about it before, but I find it odd that no one sent word to Levin about Kitty, especially the prince who really likes Levin, who would like him to marry Kitty. Favourite line, Lasker, a fine time to talk. Oh no, wait, this is a translation in the Bartlett. A fine time to talk, she was thinking. There's one on the way. Sure enough, here it is, they'll miss it. Dogs. Dogs are the best. It is weird that no one told Levin about Kitty, but I suppose news travelled slowly back then. Vinny Too Cool said, after reading these last two chapters, I don't think Kitty is a good match for Levin at all. She's an 18-year-old Moscow girl who likes balls, or at least used to, socialising and ice skating. Yeah, they don't seem that well matched. Levin's pretty cool dude. I want to hang out on his farm and go hunting with him. Like, it just seems awesome. Seems so nice there. Maybe get one of those little baby lambs and eat it. Have some lamb, fresh lamb. Oh, mate. Jan Brunt said, I loved this chapter. Sorry if anyone doesn't like the thought of killing and eating a lamb. I suppose that's the, hunter in me. I was going to say the Italian side of me, but I'm also half British, and I'm sure they ate lamb in England too. Jan Brunt said, I loved this chapter. The character of Stever feels like a bit of a comic relief, but the humour feels earned and authentic. I laughed a lot when he was ruining Levin's morning. Good girl, Lasker, says Lorenzo De Medici. That's it for the conversation part of the show. Oh, my phone's doing phone things. Oh, hello, friend. Might just put that on silent real quick. Sorry, got completely distracted by my phone going buzz buzz at 12:30 in the morning. half past midnight. Chapter 16 of part 2 of Anna Karenina goes a little bit like this. On their way home, Levin inquired the particulars of Kitty's illness and of the Shabatsky's plans, and though he would have been ashamed to confess it, what he heard was agreeable to him. It was agreeable because there was still hope for him, and even more because she was suffering, she who had made him suffer so much. Ooh, dark. Levin, that's dark. But when Oblonsky began to speak of what caused Kitty's illness and to mention Vronsky's name, Levin interrupted him. I have no right whatsoever to know such family details, and frankly, I am not interested in them either. Oblonsky gave a scarcely perceptible smile on noticing the quick change so familiar to him in Levin's face, which became as gloomy as it had been bright a moment before. Have you finally settled with Ryabinin about the forest? Asked Levin. Yes, I have. I'm getting a splendid price for it. 38,000 rubles, 8 at once, and the rest to be paid within 6 years. I have been bothering about it a long time. No one would give more. The fact is, you are giving the forest away, said Levin moodily. Why giving it away? Said Oblonsky, with a good-natured smile, knowing well that everything would now seem wrong to Levin, because the forest is worth at least 500 rubles. A desyatina, replied Levin. Oh, you're a country gentleman, said Oblonsky jokingly, and your tone of contempt for us poor town folk, but when it comes of getting business done, we do it better than anyone, believe me. I have reckoned it all out, continued he, and have sold the forest so well that I am afraid he may change his mind. You know, it's not timber, but for the most part only fit for fuel, said he, hoping by this remark finally to convince Levin of the injustice of his suspicions, and it will not yield more than 10 zassins of wood to the desyatina, and he is paying me at the rate of 200 rubles. Zassins is fuel wood, which was sold by the zassin. Levin smiled contemptuously. I know this manner, he thought, not his only, but all townsmen who visit the country two or three times in 10 years get hold of two or three expressions, use them in and out of season, and are firmly convinced they know everything. Timber and yield 10 zassins. He uses these words, but understands nothing about the business. I should not try to teach you the things you scribble about at your office, he said, but in case of need would come to you for advice about them. But you are firmly convinced that you understand all the forest law. It is not easy. Have you counted the trees? How can one count the trees? Said Oblonsky, still anxious to dispel his friend's ill humour. Count grains of sand and planet's rays, even though a lofty mind were able? Well, Ryabinin's lofty mind is able to do it, and no dealer will ever buy without first counting, unless the forest is given to him for nothing, as you are doing. I know your forest. I go shooting there every year, and it is worth 500 rubles a desyatina, cash down, and he is paying you 200 on long term. That means that you have made him a present of about 30,000 rubles. Come, don't get so carried away, said Oblonsky piteously. Why did no one offer more? Because he and the other dealers are in league, and he has bought them off. I have had dealings with them all, and I know them. They are not genuine dealers, but sharks. He would not consider a deal which would bring him in 10 or 15%. He waits till he can buy at a fifth of the value. Oh, come, you are down in the dumps today. Not at all, said Levin gloomily, just as they drove up to the house. At the porch stood a little cart strongly bound with leather and iron, and to the cart was harnessed a well-fed horse with broad, tightly stretched straps. In the cart sat Ryabinin's clerk, who also performed a coachman's duties, his skin tightly stretched over his full-bodied face, and his belt drawn tight. Ryabinin himself was already in the house and met the two friends in the hall. He was a tall, spare, middle-aged man with a moustache, a prominent shaven chin, and prominent dim eyes. He wore a long-skirted blue coat with buttons very low at the back, his high boots drawn quite straight over the calves of his legs and crinkled around the ankles, and over them he had on a pair of large galoshes. He wiped his face all round with his handkerchief, and smoothing his coat, which was already quite in order, smilingly greeted the new arrivals. He held out his hand to Oblonsky as if he were trying to catch something. So you have come, said Oblonsky, taking his hand. That's right. I dared not disobey your excellency's commands, though the roads are quite too bad. I have literally had to walk all the way, but I have arrived in time. Konstantin Dmitrich, my respects to you, he said, turning to Levin and trying to catch his hand too, but Levin, frowning, pretended not to see the hand and began taking the snipe out of the game bag. Taking the snipe out of the game bag. You have been pleased to amuse yourself with shooting? What kind of bird may that be? Added Ryabinin, looking contemptuously at the snipe. Something tasty? And he shook his head disapprovingly, as if much doubting whether this game were worth the candle. Would you like to go into my study? Said Levin, frowning moodily and addressing Oblonsky in French. Go into the study. You can talk things over there. That would do very well, or wherever you like, remarked Ryabinin, with contemptuous dignity, as if to show them that though others might find it difficult to know how to behave with different people, yet for him no difficulty of any kind could ever exist. On entering the study, Ryabinin looked around by force of habit, as though to find the icon. But after finding it, he did not cross himself. He glanced at the book cupboards and bookshelves with the same look of doubt as he had bestowed on the snipe, smiled contemptuously, and again shook his head disapprovingly, decidedly refusing to admit that this game could be worth the candle. Well, have you brought the money? Asked Oblonsky. Take a seat. There won't be any difficulty about the money. I've come to see you and to talk matters over. Talk what matters over? But do take a seat. I can do that, said Ryabinin, sitting down and putting his arm on the back of his chair with a most uncomfortable way. You must let me off something, Prince. You're wronging me. As to the money, it is already to the last kopeck. There will be no delay about the money. Levin, who had been putting away his gun in a cupboard, was just going out of the door, but on hearing the dealer's words, he stopped. As it is, you are getting the forest for next to nothing, he said. He came to me too late, else I would have fixed the price. Ryabinin rose and smiled silently, surveying Levin from his feet to his head. He is very close, is Konstantin Dmitrich, he said, addressing Oblonsky with a smile. It's absolutely impossible to buy anything of him. I've been bargaining with him for wheat and offering a good price. Why should I give you what is mine for nothing? I have not found it on the ground nor stolen it. Oh dear, no. Nowadays it is quite impossible to steal. Absolutely everything nowadays goes before a jury. Everything is judged honourably. There's no possibility of stealing. We speak honestly. It's too much for the forest. There's no making any profit on it. I am asking to have something knocked off, if only a trifle. Well, have you settled the business or not? If you have, there's no use bargaining, but if not, said Levin, I will buy the forest myself. The smile vanished from Ryabinin's face, which assumed a hawk-like, rapacious and cruel expression. With his bony fingers, he rapidly unfastened his coat, exposing his braided shirt and brass buttons of his waistcoat and a watch chain, and quickly took out a thick old pocketbook. If you please, the forest is mine, he said, rapidly crossing himself and holding out his hand. Take your money. The forest is mine. That's the way Ryabinin does business. No fussing about kopecks, he said, frowning and flourishing his pocketbook. If I were you, I should not be in a hurry to take it, remarked Levin. What do you mean? Said Oblonsky with surprise. Why, I've given my word. Levin went out and slammed the door. Ryabinin looked at it and smiled, shaking his head. That's all his youthfulness, his absolute childishness. Why, I am making this purchase, believe me, just for the honour and glory of the thing, so that it should be Ryabinin and not another that has brought Oblonsky's forest. But it's still a question whether, by God's mercy, I can make a profit, believe me, before God. Please, sir, the agreement must be written. An hour later, the dealer, with his coat well lapped over and the hooks of his overcoat carefully fastened, and with the agreement in his pocket, seated himself in his little cart and drove home. Oh, these gentlefolks, he remarked to his clerk, while hooking up the leather apron of the cart, regular objects. But may I congratulate you on the purchase, Mikhail Ignatievich. Well, well. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Have your say about this one over at the subreddit. Other than that, thank you very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.